Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? Most people don't think about their space as an Airbnb, but hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle. If you have a home but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, they're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet and powering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase N.A. member FDIC 2024 JPMorgan Chase & Co.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I am joined by actor Betty Gilpin. You likely first saw Gilpin in Glow, the Netflix original series about a group of women participating in a kind of makeshift wrestling organization. In it, Gilpin played Debbie Egan, a mother and former soap star who joins Glow after discovering her husband has cheated on her with her best friend, played by Alison Brie. The show ran from 2017 to 2020, with Gilpin receiving an Emmy nomination for each of its three seasons. She's now returned with a new series called Mrs. Davis, created by Tara Hernandez and Damon Lindelof. At the top of this episode, Betty and I attempt to offer a logline, but essentially, the titular Mrs. Davis is a kind of omniscient artificial intelligence with the direct line to most sentient people. That is, except for a small resistance spearheaded by a nun named Simone, played by Gilpin, who aims to dismantle this not-so-benevolent algorithm. In case you needed further clarity, and I'm sure you do, here's a clip from the trailer.
Is it okay if I proxy?
Sorry, she'll speak to me through here, and then I'll just repeat whatever she says.
Not she. It.
It is a machine.
She wants to talk.
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 Talk. Talk to you.
If I say no, it's just going to send someone else, isn't it?
Probably.
You are the only person on the planet who can fulfill this quest. You must locate the Holy Grail.
Mrs. Davis is all-knowing and all-powerful. She not only knows you're coming for her, but she wants you to.
Mrs. Davis?
Don't give it a name! No one calls Facebook Doug.
That was from Mrs. Davis. New episodes are available to stream every Thursday on Peacock. Gilpin is excellent in this genre-bending, prescient series that interrogates the intersection of artificial intelligence and faith, and how society, in an increasingly vexing and digitized future, may turn to both for answers. But the central questions of Mrs. Davis around identity and purpose are basically what Betty and I try to wrestle with in this conversation. We talk about growing up backstage in New York theater, studying under the great Diane Wiest, the objectification she experienced as a young actor out of college, the turning point that was GLOW, and of course her recent essay collection entitled All the Women in My Brain and Other Concerns. Without further ado, this is Betty Gilpin. Betty Gilpin, pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, Sam.
Now, I know walking into the studio today,
yep,
you may have noticed there are auditions being held for the role of Bikini Barista. And I just want to clarify, it's not related to Talk Easy.
Okay, this is not my callback for Bikini Barista. I love that I just promoted myself to callback immediately. Could be a pre-screen. We used to call, you could have an audition and then a callback. And then there was a thing before an audition that we used to call a Timothy McVeigh when you walked in and realized there was no casting director. It was like the casting director's assistant, no camera. And it was like the purpose was to make sure you weren't Timothy McVeigh. And then you would be allowed to audition next time.
Well, my sense is post-Emmy nomination.
Yeah.
You'd probably get a callback nowadays.
You know, you'd think. Still a lot of self-tapes on my bathroom floor. When I walked in, I had a wave of trauma and terror thinking, I think I've cried in this hallway. I don't know what casting office is here, but I know that something happened in this hallway. I still audition all the time. It's just mostly self-tapes now. I don't know how much in-person audition is happening
right,
anymore.
Of course. And I don't mean to laugh at your trauma.
No. I've marketed laughing at trauma. That's how I pay my mortgage.
I heard that was the first title of your book, right? That was the working title.
Laughing at Trauma, L-A-T.
Okay. We could continue to talk about the Bikini Barista.
Yeah.
But I think we should talk about this new show of yours. It's called Mrs. Davis. I have seen the first three episodes of the show.
Okay. You must be so confused.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I was starting to write out my description of it.
Yeah.
And then I thought, this is really an exercise in futility. So I'm just going to put it to you.
Yep.
As someone who lived in the space of the show for a long time. How do you explain it to your family and friends? Like, what's your log line?
First, I take a deep breath.
Okay, we can do it together.
Yeah. You know, I describe the tone as No Country for Old Looney Tunes. I would describe the plot as it takes place in a society not unlike our own, where an algorithm, a Siri or Alexa-like algorithm, has kind of taken over and purports to be benevolent, and most people love her. She claims to have solved the world's problems. She's in an earbud in everyone's ear all the time. But there is a small faction of society, myself, Simone the Nun included, that do not trust her, think she's evil, and want her wiped from society. And Simone is a very specific kind of nun with a specific entryway into her religious life, I would say.
As opposed to the non-specific nuns?
Well, I mean, there is a very particular nun origin story for her. If you haven't seen it yet and want to have a spoiler-free experience, I would go pause this podcast, watch the first two episodes at least, and then come back.
I would add to someone who's hosting the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Please go ahead.
Maybe instead of pausing and abandoning the tape, which we would really like you to stay for.
Right.
Maybe skip ahead 90 seconds.
Okay, great. Yes. All right.
In the audio.
So Simone falls in love with a guy, a real dude who happens to be, you know, Jesus Christ. And she becomes a nun in order to keep seeing her boyfriend.
Yeah, so just standard television.
Yeah, yeah.
Run-of-the-mill.
Straightforward.
You know when people are like, ugh, we're all out of fresh ideas?
Yeah.
And then you see a show like this and you're like, well, maybe not all out.
Yes, right. Yeah. And these are like 100 ideas in one show. And, you know, when we were filming it, even 6 months ago, it wasn't as prescient as we thought. It, you know, ChatGPT now and OpenAI, it's so much more a part of our headlines than it was certainly when we were filming, and it's pretty terrifying and intense.
The artificial intelligence in this show, it's something, like you said, that people turn to for solace, answers, and inspiration.
And comfort and validation.
All these things.
Yep.
And we see characters like sporting these kind of newfangled AirPods where the AI talks through them and communicates with them. And your character abstains from all of that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, as someone who also, away from the show, abstains from social media.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
Right. I mean, I don't have public Instagram where I'm posting selfies from, like, Kelly Ripa, but I do have private, like, I'm addicted just as much as everyone else is.
Okay,
I'm
so
not,
you are.
Like, reading Hemingway alone and all analog on top of a mountain. I am watching YouTube on the toilet just like everyone else. I'm horribly addicted
really?
To the internet. Yeah.
Okay, you know what? Like, I have to cross out my, because my next question was, like, what are your thoughts on The Sun Also Rises? So I think I just want to...
I actually mention in my book that I find The Sun Also Rises, I find 5-word declarative sentences over and over and over again to be a little boring. Tell me what's going on emotionally. Give me one run-on sentence. Ernest, we share a birthday, by the way, Ernest and I.
That's probably the only thing you two share.
Totally. Depression.
Right. We can keep going. So my initial question was going to be, you seemingly are someone that has some distance from the social media structure that most of us have bought into. And yet now you're telling me that you're also part of the problem.
You know, I do try to have some rules around it. I think my feeling towards public social media or my aversion or fear of it is more like I'm afraid of building my rapidly fading youth. I don't want it to be a foundation block of my business model because it's going away and I want to work for a long time. I'm afraid of making looking hot in a tight dress a necessary part of me getting jobs that I want.
We share that.
Because, you know, it's smoke and mirrors and it gets harder and harder to do. I don't know. I want to work forever and I don't. Yeah, I'm afraid of what social media values or would make me value about myself. And then that thing disappears and then I'm just an empty chasm of a person. But some people have found a beautiful way to make it work for them. I don't want to speak for everyone else, just for my overly sensitive self. But I think my character, Simone, worries about some similar things that I worry about, which is if we rely on this robot, algorithm, whatever, if we have all the answers in our pocket all the time on our phones, do we stop asking the big questions? Like, what are we gambling with? Are we sealing off a portal to the intangible and inexplicable? And for Simone, it's her connection to her faith. But for me, as Betty, I think about the ability to be creative or existential or to wonder and wander. If a robot puppy is doing all the wondering and wandering for us, do we lose that ability? And that really freaks me out. And, you know, raising my 2.5-year-old daughter, I snatch screens away from her like they're poison. And then I'm watching Millie Bobby Brown's press tour on YouTube while I pee, or else I can't pee because I'm so addicted to it.
Right.
So I'm addicted to the poison that I'm trying to protect my daughter from. A hypocrite.
A human being.
Mm.
You said about this role recently that most of my roles have my Catholic ancestors on a permanent rotisserie grave spin. Not being able to watch it because I am sobbing and naked in everything I do. So finally, I'm playing a nun who keeps the habit zipped to the chin.
I do.
Naturally, I have to ask you, how does it feel to take your ancestors off that rotisserie grave spin? Like, has the Catholic guilt washed away?
Well, I don't know how people are going to react to the show. The Catholics or the atheists or the, you know, I remember talking to 2 different crew members while we were filming, and one of them said, I have a very complicated relationship with the church. I'm an atheist now. That's why I'm here doing this show. And another person said, I'm very devout and I love the way that religion is portrayed in the show. That's why I'm here. So So I'm like, which one of you is going to be mad? Or are they both going to be happy? Or are they both going to be mad? I don't know.
What, can it not be both?
I'm sure it'll be both and all or none.
I guess that my real question is, this role seems to demand 100% of you in a way that maybe some of your past work hasn't.
Mm.
What does that look like, both in the preparation, but then also when you have to go home and like hold the performance back, you know, at your house away from set?
You know, I think the parts, I mean, listen, maybe Bikini Barista is incredible, but I have auditioned for and played Bikini Barista many times, a version of it where you're being asked to do 10%, 5% of what you can do. And those are the jobs where you're tearing your hair out. I'm sure there are brilliant women sitting downstairs right now being like, are you kidding me? Bikini Barista? Where is my Hamlet barista? I'll still wear the bikini. So, you know, while it was doing that film schedule with the two-year-old, whatever, yes, it was exhausting and demanding, but I've been waiting for this for 36 years, Sam. And
who was that?
That was the real me. So, yeah, especially because, you know, the show really, as you saw in three episodes, it changes genre every 2 minutes. And that, to me, is like the ultimate acting cat toy. It just is a dream.
In the case of like Gaslit or Three Women, I know you don't always meet the people you're playing, but as I understand it, your father, who's also an actor, introduced you to three different nuns.
Yeah.
Ahead of this performance.
Yeah.
How was that?
Incredible, actually. First of all, yeah, I feel a lot of parallels to my character in Mrs. Davis because, you know, my character was raised by two magicians. And I was raised by two actors. You know, I was raised kind of seeing the strings being pulled and being part of the trick and knowing that there's an illusion that you're pulling over on the audience and everything can be explained. And then my dad was also a priest. So he had this other side of his life where not everything can be explained. And it's sort of there is no wizard on one hand and there is maybe a wizard on the other. So I always had those kind of two sides to my childhood, like my character. And yeah, my dad set me up with a couple Zooms with some nun friends of his.
Never thought you'd say that sentence.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they were amazing. I think I thought of nuns as pious, meek, one-dimensional, white-knuckling a certain way of life, cut off from society and what's going on to disconnect. And I was very, very wrong. While they may cut themselves off from certain aspects of society, the purpose is to hyper-connect.
Mm.
And they're like living meditations as people. I was very, very inspired by my conversations with them.
It's fascinating. The parallels between your parents in the show, who are magicians,
yeah,
and your parents in your life, who are actors. Like the first time you begin to understand the magic trick of acting, I believe comes around the age of 10. This is the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
Your family has just left the South Street Seaport in New York City, moved to rural Roxbury, Connecticut. And there's this one night where you attend a performance of a play at Hartford Stage, where your father plays a man who has abandoned his wife and kids. What did you make of that performance?
Oh, wow. Sam did his research. It was very emotional for me. I grew up, you know, it's a different world now where you can kind of live anywhere. But in the 90s, New York actors really did theater and Law and Order. And that's really what my parents did mostly. They did tons of other stuff, but a lot of theater. And I really grew up watching them in tons of plays. So I'd seen them in many plays, but seeing my dad give this monologue in a British accent about leaving his family, it just made me realize, oh, there are parts of my dad that I don't know. I feel like even as adults, you know, a moment where you're hanging out with your parents and then you say goodbye. And then do you ever like look back at them walking away, or you see them kind of in the wild out of the context of you? And it's very jarring. It's still jarring to me even as a 36-year-old. And that was kind of the first moment where I realized, oh, acting is accessing different people in you or different roads that your life could go down. And it was both very terrifying to me and really exciting. you know, having a kid now, I realize, oh, it really was the ultimate gift that my parents' job was to put themselves in every situation possible and to, you know, use their imaginations to the full extent of their capabilities. It was a pretty amazing way to grow up.
I'm curious about your relationship to acting from like a child to a teenager, because you once said, I fell in love with the magic of acting when I was little. And then when I was 15, I realized, oh, I have a darkness in me that might kill me. Let's try to funnel this into something.
So dramatic. Yeah. I was so desperate to be a child star and so angry at my parents that they wouldn't let me. The kind of house rule was, okay, if you want to do this, you have to go to college first. But, you know, my love for it when I was a kid was very Guys and Dolls, Annie, memorizing my parents' lines and just totally joy-based. And then as an adolescent, feeling I had depression and I was pretty sad. And while it was definitely a weight, was also a window. I felt like, oh, that I'm accessing a different part of my creativity and the way that I think in a way that doesn't just have to do with Nathan Detroit and Skye Masterson characters in Guys and Dolls. So yeah, when I started doing theater in school, in high school, I think I was using some of that sadness as well as my love for it and tried to find eventually a healthy blend of the two, you know, which is kind of what you major in college if you major in theater.
In high school,
yeah,
did it feel like the way you're describing back then? Or did you only later understand it as that blending of two, the window and weight? Like, did it feel like that then?
Our theater program was pretty incredible. And I was really, really, really depressed in high school, which I know is not a unique trait. But I think that I did feel like I was able to channel it into something instead of it just being a spiral into my dorm room floor. I went to boarding school. I probably wasn't cognizant that, oh, I am using my depression to funnel my future livelihood. I think I was just stoned and sad and memorizing, oh, that this tutu cellulite flesh would melt.
You know, it's fascinating because both of your parents are like pretty successful working actors. And yet, as you've said a couple times already, they tried to deter you from acting. And when you majored in theater at Fordham, they only allowed you to do so with certain conditions, which included you going from math class to movement class to Spanish to photography every day. And as much as I'd love to talk about your movement class, perhaps we'd be best served talking about the acting class you took with performer Diane Wiest.
Yes.
Now, she had an exercise.
Oh, no. Yeah.
That I wondered maybe you could share with people listening. What did that sound like? What was that like?
Okay. Oh, my God. Diane Wiest, an incredible actor.
One of my favorites.
I had the privilege of having her as a teacher, but we did play a rather strange game.
Oh, that was a preface. Okay.
We did play a game called Nothing. She was like, the object of the game is you say the word nothing with nothing attached to it. So we'll have Betty come to the foreground and Betty just say nothing with nothing. And so you would just sit in a chair and go, nothing. And she would go, still something. Okay.
Nothing.
Oh, something, wouldn't you say?
Nothing.
Oh, that was more something than anything I've heard. And it would go on and on. And people cried. No one, I think, achieved nothing.
Could she?
Oh, of course. There's nothing Diane Wiest can't achieve.
I just felt dropped back into Hannah and her sisters. That was fantastic.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I heard there was another game as well where she would ask scene partners to look into each other's eyes.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. So we would partner up and she said, she was like, okay, everybody partner up, stare deep into your partner's eyes. And convey with a look your wildest dreams. And then, in response, give your partner a look that lets them know that their dreams will never come true. We were like, oh my. And I had taken mushrooms that day.
No.
And I...
Before class?
Almost passed away. Yes, yes. I had ill-timed the mushroom stamp. Maybe even thought they would help. It didn't help receiving a look that my dreams would never come true on mushrooms. Do not recommend.
Wow. Yeah, you thought in terms of like...
I was like, today my dreams will come true.
Approximating nothing
yes.
or dreams coming true.
Yeah.
Mushrooms may help.
I thought I'd be safe.
You know, as silly and unbelievable as that exercise clearly was, is what were your wildest dreams at that time?
You know, I think that growing up in backstage New York theater, I was like, I want to do New York theater. And I think that I had a pretty healthy sense that the percentage of people that get to wear gowns and hold statues and buy real estate from acting is a very, very small, sometimes not so deserving section of the population. And it's not...
Was that also the real you?
The accent that I do, yes. Yeah, when I turn into an older lady in a kimono, that's me. This is, you know, an avatar.
This is also another question.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't your parents working actors that were successful and maybe owned a home?
Yeah. Yes, but it...
It was different.
Yeah, I just had a healthy sense of realism. You know, it's not a merit-based system, and I didn't want to set myself up for aiming high and then landing low.
And you learned that in college, or that was the sort of cumulative experience of growing up with your parents working in this field?
I think that I still remember there are actors that my parents did plays with in regional theater who... they would walk on stage and the air would change from how good of actors they were. Those people are the ones who deserve Pacific Palisades mansions, not the vocal fry influencers who have them.
Huh?
What?
This thing on?
Yeah.
I'm a renter, if that helps.
Oh, great. Yeah. Perfect.
So the answer to your wildest dreams... was not turning into a vocal fry influencer who owns a home in the Palisades.
Oh God, no offense to them, not to alienate them. They're better business people than I.
And then they're a huge part of our base listening.
Oh, yeah, I bet. No, that was not the goal.
So what was it at 2021, like graduating Fordham? I mean, your last few weeks of school are kind of remarkable. Like you open a show on Off-Broadway,
mm-hmm.
you take your final exams, you move out of wherever you were living near campus. All of this is happening pretty quickly after you receive a diploma.
Yeah. The rule that I had to graduate college before I started working professionally, I kind of bent those rules a little bit. I did graduate, but I played a dead body on Law & Order sophomore year, I think, and did my first job was this indie movie that my parents were auditioning for and took me out to lunch when I was stoned. And they mentioned that there was a part for a 17-year-old sarcastic person with cleavage. I was like, that's a role I was born to play. Give me 5 minutes.
By the way, on that film, you got a job and they did not.
Yeah. And the guy who played my brother is now my husband.
Wow.
Yeah. I definitely auditioned a lot. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bikini barista auditions with no callback.
But you were performing a lot on stage.
Yeah, I did a bunch of off-Broadway theater, which was incredible, and got to work with the best actors I've ever worked with.
You said of that work, with theater, the time commitment and the demands on your body, your personal life, and your wallet are crazy. It's 4 months of feeling like you're running a marathon and getting paid and hugs. You're telling your body there's an emergency every night, and then saying, just kidding, we're doing it twice again tomorrow.
Ugh, I hate that I said that. Wow. It's the best. I don't know when I said that. I disagree. I mean, I guess I agree with everything,
but it's also... in different ways.
No.
I was quoting the most generous one.
Oh, shit. Theater is a miracle. Everyone support your local theater.
I'm just playing with it. No, I mean, but I mean... we can wah-wah our way like out of this studio and go home. But I think like let's try to hold it for what it was, which is asking your body to go to those places, whether it's in theater or on screen, and then having to go back home. Yes, everyone listening knows there are bigger problems. And
yes, right.
There's no violin being played. But what does that do to your central nervous system to like call upon it in a way that is intense.
Yeah.
And then ask to like go to dinner later.
I mean, I think I've found becoming a parent has made my emotional metabolism much faster and quick. You know, I think when I was doing a play at 24, I would do an emotional scene and I could feel my body think there was a bear in the room for 3 hours after the play. And I think I thought, in order for a scene to go well, I have to convince 99% of my brain and body that this is really happening, that there's a real emergency. And I think that's not very healthy. I hope that I have found a healthier way.
Is that way opening your phone and looking at pictures of Jonestown?
Oh my God. Why do I ever open my mouth to speak or commit pen to paper? Yes, so I... Oh, God, have pictures of Jonestown. I used to look at pictures of Jonestown, which is no laughing matter. You know, I think... I used to feel very superstitious and fearful that I wouldn't be able to access the portal to creativity or the portal to darkness or the chamber of ideas or whatever. I think that I've chalked it up all to this sort of magic chemistry that had to happen that was sort of out of my control. And I would do things like look at pictures of Jonestown on my phone to be like, oh, the witch is in the room. You know, the scene's going to go well because I have a foot in the river of death and understanding.
Oh my God.
Is, you know, just ridiculous.
Yeah. But it worked. I mean, I've seen Glow.
But I wasn't. Yeah. But now I'm.
You wouldn't do that for Glow.
I mean, I think
that... I love how you're smiling and gasping your way through the actor's process.
I don't really have a real process. I just try to keep myself out of my own head, I would say. Keep it loose. I spin around a lot before every take. That's what I do.
That's exactly how I start these podcasts.
It works. It just makes you think you're going to throw up or drown, and it makes you forget how neurotic and insane you are.
Yeah, and then you're dropped right back into it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I bring all this up because there is such a ferocity to your work. You don't do the kind of acting that I think you've railed against in the past, which you've called whisper acting.
Yeah, I could stand to whisper a little more.
No, I think you and Natasha Lyonne had this conversation, and I love her dearly. You two are not whisper actors.
No, we're not mumblecore. We'd probably work more if we were.
Yeah, you two are really struggling.
We had our years.
Yeah, both of you just have hit Peacock shows. Yeah, no, totally.
It took a while, Sam.
But tapping into that, it must take something out of you.
You know, I'm not like arriving on set in a cloak with headphones being like, can I have the room, please? This is cool. You know, and I'm not shivering on the way home anymore as I was 24 on the subway coming home from my emo performance off Broadway. I'm making fart jokes till action, and then I'm gossiping the moment we yell cut. Most of my best friends are also actors, and I think I really only connect to people who are super passionate and also super embarrassed by what we do. I think it means so much to me. I love being an actor. Could cry talking about how much I love being an actor. I also find it super cringy, ridiculous, unimportant, out of touch, insane. I do think a great performance can change the world and move you and whatever. But I think that method acting or being like, that part altered my DNA and I could never leave. You know, Cleopatra was with me to the end. Yeah, I don't know if I buy it, Sam.
I'm almost certain you don't.
I don't.
And I think we have oscillated back and forth between those two people throughout this conversation.
Right, yeah. And the next quote is me saying from 7 years ago, Cleopatra has never left me. Go ahead, read it. Just put me on blast.
I was wondering, am I predictable or are you? I'm wondering, because I'm reading these quotes.
Or is
here.
This a simulation?
That's episode 4 of Mrs. Davis.
It's not.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. Our Airbnb even had a balcony that overlooked the Colosseum. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? You could just host a spare extra room, or you could Airbnb your whole home while you're away to earn some extra money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello. This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. In my book, David and Goliath, I tried to figure out how some people find the strength to take on the established way of thinking and turn it upside down. What does it take to be a disruptor? And I concluded that a disruptor is someone with a rare combination of three traits. First, you have to be open. You have to be willing to see and do things in new ways. Secondly, you have to be conscientious, to follow through and make things happen. Those two are obvious. But the third one is the crucial one. You have to be willing to do what you think is right, even when everyone around you thinks you're an idiot. There isn't a brilliant innovator in history who wasn't surrounded by naysayers. Most of us can't take that kind of criticism and we fold, but the disruptor doesn't. They soldier on. I've been looking at disruptors and their success stories a lot lately, partly because I'm working on a follow-up to The Tipping Point, and market disruption plays a key role in how ideas take off, but also because I'm going to be the keynote speaker at this year's Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business. It's an event where customers are recognized for kicking convention to the curb to elevate their company, while also doing meaningful things for their community and even the world. In fact, I'll be presenting the first ever Tipping Point designation, a new special distinction honoring one entrant that sparked transformative change for their organization. If this event sounds like your thing, I encourage you to find out more or even enter the Unconventional Awards to be recognized for your disruptive thinking. Win a donation to a charity of your choice, and much more. You can enter before July 31st at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. I'll save you a seat.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JP Morgan Chase & Co.
When you look back on the part of Glow, which is really where a lot of people were introduced to you and your work, when it debuted back in 2017, how much of Debbie's journey on the show reflected your own off of it?
Yeah, there were definitely parallels. I think that Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch, who created Glow, they were also staff writers on the show Nurse Jackie that I did the last three seasons of. And my character on Nurse Jackie was conceived by men, the new male showrunners of the show. It was sort of like, how are we going to get viewers to keep watching season five of a show about tough women who are good at their jobs? Let's have a slutty woman who's bad at her job. Enter Gilpin. And, you know, you saw my areolas before you saw my face on the show. It's the truth. And I signed up for it because I was like, I want this job and I want to work with Edie Falco and Merritt Weaver and Anna Deavere Smith. But I think Liz Flahive and Carly Mensch started to realize that I wanted to do weird character stuff and less archbacky stuff, but had really mostly paid my bills playing those archy-backy parts on camera. And I think Debbie on Glow is a soap actress who has mostly used her craft, as it were, to play kind of Barbie people instead of mezzanine, chest-pounding, Greek-level people. And yeah, I think Liz and Carly knew that about me and kind of wrote that into the show.
What was that like?
The best. So much fun. Totally surreal. And yeah, I got the part 3 days before my wedding. And I don't know, I think I had told myself, like, oh, I'm not going to get married until I'm at X point in my career. Or I'm not going to put roots down until, you know, I think I was just waiting on the entertainment business to make me feel like, okay, now I can live the rest of my life. And someone told me once, never choose the business because it will never choose you. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to live my life whether or not I get my big break or not. I'm going to stop waiting for it or thinking that the answer to my life is around the corner or a call from my agent away. And it's almost like the second I sort of said that out loud is when things started to happen. But the same is still true. You know, what I try to talk about in my book, All the Women in My Brain, is that, you know.
No, you could just be proud of the book. Okay. And not sell it like that.
Okay. No, well, that's the, you know, that's the brand.
The brand?
Yeah. The brand is performed self-deprecation and vulnerability for claps
that's
and
good.
Appetizers.
I'm all for felt. Instead of perform. But,
okay,
but
great.
You can do, you know, you can do you and yeah. I can do me.
Okay, great.
We can meet in the middle.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, what I try to talk about in the book that I am proud of having written, Sam.
I feel like your mom.
No, that wouldn't be my mom.
Your dad?
Maybe, sure.
Your two younger siblings?
The lesson I learned that I tried to talk about in the book is that no professional accomplishment is going to make you feel like now my identity has clicked and I am a full person. And it's always going to feel like fraudulent and strange and like you're almost there. So best not place any value on it at all because it's all going to go away. It is. We're all going to die. I don't know if you knew that. That's our time. A word from our sponsors.
You wrote about some of what you're talking about here, just like a year after you did get the call to do Glow. It was in a Hollywood Reporter article called Why Acting is a Seesaw of Death. And that image of a seesaw, I don't know if it's true, but I think it comes from an article that actor Frank Langella once wrote.
So I had never read this article before I wrote this article.
Really?
Yeah. I swear to God.
Okay, well, the article he wrote was published in the New York Times back in 1989. It was called The Demon Seesaw Actor's Ride. In it, he wrote, some basic truths about us, some fundamentals, married, single, divorced, rich, broke, breaking in or holding on the morning after Oscar, Tony, or Emmy, or struggling along without recognition. Whether we are newcomers, superstars, an enduring light, a flash in the pan, a has-been, a comeback king, from low self-esteem to insufferable arrogance, we are the seesaw kids. Kids who hold on tight and wait for the call, the audition, the part, the review, and then we do it again. Those are the ground rules. You accept them if you are an actor, and you accept the demons too.
Mm-hmm. But far better said than my jumble.
I knew you were going to say that. That was true to him as a man. Working in Hollywood in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel reflective of your experience now?
Yes. And I think that that's yet another reason why I'm not on public social media is I think it really multiplies that feeling of extreme highs and extreme lows. You're either put on a crazy undeserved pedestal or under a crazy undeserved guillotine, and it's one or the other, and somewhere in the middle is the truth. Like, you're just a rosaceaed person with a bad back struggling for validation as the glaciers melt. Like, you're not special, you're not unspecial, you're just a person. And it's a strange thing, you know, like being on a press tour, for instance. Now part of the selling of a thing or getting someone to watch something you sort of have to cosplay as the trading card version of yourself. And a stylist puts you in clothes that aren't yours and makeup that isn't your face. And
are you the trading card today?
No. Well, I was told there were no pictures, so I washed off the patriarchy car wash and I'm in my stained sweatshirt. This is me.
This is more you
yes.
than normal.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't mind this as a trading card either, but
thanks. Yeah, what are you saying? I just think there's even more of a seesaw now, I think, than in 1989, where you're either pretending to be some sort of demigod version of yourself, or you are being dragged across the internet as someone who deserves the death penalty for the wrong socks.
So the trading card version of yourself.
Yeah.
It's an unnerving idea. But the reason one would or does have a trading card is because they have done something to warrant said trading card. In your case, it's the work of being an actor. And I'm curious, when you look at your approach or your artistic aims, how do you think they differ generationally from you and your parents? You have this quote.
Okay.
I think I realized generationally between my parents that we approach acting in a different way. They were doing theater in the spirit of, there's so much dark shit. Let's build a stage over it and tap dance on top of it and celebrate life and be ensemble members of this production of Hay Fever and celebrate and escape. And I'm like, as an actor, let's rip that trapdoor open.
I mean, yeah, I think the trading card thing of it all, too. It's, for instance, I reached this point in my career where I stopped auditioning as much and started having meetings where it became less about, like, I don't care who you are outside of this room, just read these sides and show me if you are would be good in this part or not. Then a meeting has nothing to do with, would you be good in this part? It's like, who are you? What are you like? How do you seem? And that will be the reason that I cast you or not. And I was really unprepared for that. And I'm still sort of bad at that. Another reason why I'm not on social media, I do think that's kind of a modern part of getting jobs and having your name in the zeitgeist or whatever, just sort of performing your identity as I make eye contact with the book I wrote about my life. Just a cowering introvert over here, just all about the Shakespeare, nothing to do with my life story that I wrote, available now. She's a hypocrite and it's working for her sometimes, but do I sleep well? I don't know.
You sleep fine. Well. No, like all hypocrites.
Yeah.
You addressed one part, but you sidestepped the thing that I'm trying to get at. And I think the thing you're trying to get at in the work,
yeah,
which is that, as you said about your parents, they approached it from, there's so much dark shit in the world. Let's build a stage over it and tap dance on it. And you seem to have a different aim. And I'm wondering if that is just a generational difference or is it just a difference inside of you?
I think that coming to terms with the fact that depression is always going to be a part of my life. And I think initially I thought, okay, how can I use this as a creative window? And I initially used it in an unhealthy way, in a way where I thought, okay, I have to kind of keep this demon fed and alive because it also gives me access to my favorite thing, my passion. And I think I realized, like, I don't have to lean into that feeling or feed it at all. It's always going to be there. I can still have access to it while also taking vitamins and drinking water and seeing friends and stuff. But while I find acting, yes, to oftentimes be cringy and embarrassing and ridiculous, I think it can be very moving. And maybe it is a generational difference, although I don't know. Diane Wiest is using the demon as well. I mean, I learned from the generation before, for sure.
Mm. You know, in terms of like generations, you've talked a lot about how this new generation of actors like Florence Pugh, Jodie Comer, Anya Taylor-Joy has given you some kind of hope about where this industry is going.
Yeah.
Do you still feel that way in 2023?
Totally. Sometimes in writing, the feminist overcorrect is to make the female character, I call it sleepy status. It's like just a person who always has the answer and, you know, is better than the person they're talking to and pausey and sort of one note kind of cool and sleepy. And there is this wave of actresses. It's like the antidote to that, which is, you know, you see a billion different things happening behind their eyes and their characters are 1,000 miles deep and different every time. And I find it really, really, really inspiring.
I guess in some ways we keep circling this, like, what is a weight and what is a window?
Mm-hmm.
Like oscillating back and forth between how you hold the work and how you keep doing it. To me, it reminds me of this great passage from your book called All the Women in My Brain. And I thought maybe you'd want to read from it as we leave.
Sure. Oh, boy. This is towards the end of my book, and I am talking about the guy who I dated and fell in love with and then later married, I guess. Okay, let's see if that's...
You two are married.
Okay,
it's
yes.
That's not a...
Yes.
Right?
yes, but I'm trying to put it in the tense of which we're jumping into this. Yes, we are married. Okay, here we go. The boy whom I would later walk down the aisle toward through crying friends, many of whom were former diapered and training broad alphas whose shine taught me shining doesn't kill you. Most were people I met the best way you can meet someone, pinching each other in backstage dark, then under the lights making kryptonite eye contact when someone in robe E farts. I walked arm in arm with my parents, the carny people who raised me to find joy and questions wherever I could, and whenever possible, funny hats. A bow-tied beast trotted behind with the rings, harumphing in boredom at the bottom of my dress throughout the ceremony. A dress that hours later on the dance floor, the drunk women who built me helped me chop short with kitchen scissors, freeing my legs from the patriarchy, or maybe just so I could kick higher to Prince. In all my running from myself, it is hard to remember that I also love the thing I'm running from, that I'm in all this for the big feelings. I don't want them to be muted, not really. But when I feel them all the way, and the ground opens, and that's terrifying. The Salem feelings are less predictable, less controllable, scarier. The Barbie stuff is smaller but easier, more numb, safer. Those lows aren't as deep and harrowing, but the moments that have felt like my cells explode into liquid sugar and I'm sobbing in a thank you to the sky have nothing to do with approval or victory, not from love, from loving. The end.
Where does that land with you?
I haven't read that in a long time. It's an interesting thing. In one's career or in this business, there are so many things that feel like your congratulations parade when things feel like they're going well. And you sort of realize, oh, those aren't the moments that you're going to remember when you're on your deathbed, even though they seem to have a lot more confetti and fanfare. I think falling in love and having the friends that I do, it's the reaching out towards someone that I'm going to remember and not the receiving. And to me, that's the reason for it all. It's why I'm grateful for starting in the theater and all those years watching my parents. I think in theater, it's so much more about the fizz between two people instead of your coverage or your coverage. It's so not self-based. It's about kind of this intangible thing between two actors. And I've carried that into my life and, you know, have to relearn that lesson over and over when I'm sure I get high on my own narcissism cloud and have to get pulled out of it. You know, I'm certainly not in the epilogue of my life where I have all the lessons learned, but I learned that lesson over and over again. And having a daughter definitely is a new chapter of learning it.
So we're not in the epilogue.
No. Unless I get hit by a bus today.
I don't even know what we'd do with the interview then. So,
oh, it'd go viral.
Selfishly.
That'd be exciting for you. Call the bus.
I guess my last question is that running you keep doing, do you still want to?
Yeah. Well, I feel very different from that person. a benefit of getting older is that something else I talk about in the book is girlhood feels so much like cycled selves. Like, am I this person or this person or this person? And you just get too tired to hate yourself as much. It's just exhausting. And it's not like I'm making out with the mirror now, but I've settled into myself a little more. Maybe this podcast has not represented a settled woman, but another symptom of having a daughter who's suddenly 2.5, who is looking at me and is on the grid of understanding, I don't want her to see a person who doesn't like themselves or who's still figuring out the best version of herself, even though, of course, I still am. But I don't want self-hate to be contagious.
Mm.
But I do like myself a lot more than I did when I was 16 years old. And I think that's all you can hope for. And also, I'm really grateful to have a job where you have to keep asking yourself the big questions and also be very silly and imaginative and be honest with your own darkness and engage with your own inner kid all the time. Regardless of whether or not my parents and I approach it in different ways, that is what they also did. And it was a pretty incredible way to grow up. And I only hope that I can give Mary some of that joy as a kid, too. So I am proud. Sam.
I have a feeling that that's going to happen for you, for Mary, whatever is next.
Yeah.
And I so thank you, truly, through all the jokes and nonsense and bits, for trying to answer some of these big questions.
Thanks for asking them.
Anytime. Betty Gilpin.
Thanks, Sam.
A pleasure. And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to give us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. Reviewing the show on these platforms is still the best way for new listeners to find Talk Easy. I want to give a special thanks this week to the teams at Shelter PR, Peacock, and of course, the one and only Betty Gilpin. The first 5 episodes of her new show, Mrs. Davis, are now available to stream on Peacock. New episodes premiere every Thursday. We'll be including a link to watch that show in our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations like this one, I'd recommend our talks with Natasha Lyonne, Pedro Pascal, Abby Jacobson, Bill Hader, Michelle Williams, Bob Odenkirk, and writer Johnny Sun. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Talk Easy Pod. If you want to support Talk Easy by purchasing one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with the inimitable Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at talkeasypod.com/shop. As always, Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by Clarice Guevara and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editor is C.J. Mitchell. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krisha Shenoy. Photographs today are by Julius Chu. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Sinica. Special thanks to Kaylin Ung. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries. They include Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Navarez, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliori, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next Sunday with the CEO of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, Jay Jordan. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.